a line of wines, Mommy Juice. Both my husband and I were absolutely convinced that alcohol was a vital and necessary part of parenting. I remember getting him a Father's Day card one year that said, quote, "It's not drinking alone if the kids are at home." Let's name this belief. I need a drink to handle my kids. Now, whether you're a parent or not, this section is incredibly powerful because what we're actually talking about is stress, drinking to relieve intense stress. Parenting happens to be one form of stress that millions of people share and that the alcohol industry has latched onto. It targets parents, especially moms, as a marketing segment. So if you're not a parent, listen anyway and substitute your stressors. Maybe you're a college student trying to get through a rigorous semester, or maybe you have a high-pressure career. Whatever that stress is for you, the same addictive processes are happening in your brain. Before we dive into deconstructing this belief, I want to tell you a story I learned from Alan Carr. He's an addiction expert who specializes in helping people quit smoking. He talks about a deadly meat-eating plant from the islands of the South Pacific called a pitcher plant. If you're an insect flying through the jungle and you catch a whiff of its amazing smelling nectar, you're instantly attracted. You fly in closer, perch inside the rim, and start to drink. It's so tasty and you're so focused on drinking that you don't notice the gradual slope under your feet, and you begin to slide down towards the center of the plant. But you've got wings, you can certainly fly out at any time, so just a couple of more sips and you'll be off. The nectar is intoxicating, so why not enjoy it? You deserve it, after all. Like all drinkers, you think that you're totally in control and can leave at any time. But the slope gradually gets steeper and steeper, and the darkness closes in around you. So you try to stop drinking and fly away, but it's too late. The pitcher plant has you completely in its grasp. And eventually, you stop drinking long enough to look down and make out a pool of dead bodies floating in the liquid. You're not drinking nectar. You're drinking the juice of other dead creatures. You are the drink. As disgusting as that story is, it illustrates a point that we don't talk about enough. Alcohol is addictive, not only to some people, but to all people. And we need to understand that something as innocent as having a glass of wine to get through making dinner for the kids can end up becoming a huge problem. The only way to get out of the trap is to avoid the trap altogether. And the only way to do that is to understand that alcohol is indeed a trap. Oftentimes, the trap is sprung and addiction takes hold when we use the substance to relieve stress. And in our society today, there aren't many things more stressful than parenting, especially when the kids are young. Clarity. Do you believe that you need a drink to handle being a parent? I totally did. I thought I was more relaxed and more present with the kids. I thought if I had a glass of wine, I could play their games longer. Where did this come from? If you start paying attention, you'll see the messages all around you. The alcohol industry has targeted parents in a major way. Everything from TV commercials to movies to social media memes. You can't scroll through Facebook for 15 seconds without seeing a post about alcohol and drinking to get through the day. We're telling ourselves this lie that we need a drink to deal with the kids. Here are some of the placards I've seen recently. "This margarita tastes like I don't even have kids." "The most expensive part of having kids is all the wine you have to drink." "Motherhood, powered by love, fueled by coffee, sustained by wine." "Wine, it's the duct tape of parenting." "Mommy's Happy Meal, a Xanax and a bottle of wine." "Dear children, you whine, I whine." "Homework, turning parents into day drinkers." Alcohol branding has gotten out of control, with wines like Mad Housewife, Mommy's Time Out, and Mommy Juice. Marketers are actually targeting stressed out moms with a substance that's only going to make things worse. Humorous Facebook pages and websites such as Mommy Needs Vodka and Hurrah for Gin are growing in popularity. In fact, this segment of the industry has seen a 25% surge in sales, which is huge growth. Parents are getting the message loud and clear. It's socially acceptable to drink away your stress. And the message is always presented as funny, but it's not. More than 40% of mothers say they drink to deal with parenting stress. And 30% say they've witnessed another mom drinking excessively on a playdate. As I wrote this, my heart was breaking thinking about the two women who emailed me in desperation because if they don't stop drinking, the court system is going to take away their children. And these are smart, successful women. They volunteer. They have powerful careers. They help out with the PTA. And they're in big trouble. One of them received a DUI with her kids in the car. I know one mom who woke up from a blackout and the last thing she could remember was being on a playdate with her toddler. She had no idea how she got home or how she had gotten her child into his crib for nap time. Talk about scary. Parents are becoming so addicted to alcohol that we risk losing our kids, and we're making jokes about it. And as heartbreaking as that is for the parents, it's even worse for the children who have to witness their parents' embarrassing and dangerous behavior. It's worse for those little boys and girls who have to leave their parents and navigate a strange new world on their own, all because their mom or dad couldn't get it together. This is harsh, I know. But I want you to understand that it's just not funny. I also want you to know that it's not your fault. If you're a parent and you drink, you're in the pitcher plant. You probably feel like you can fly out and it's not a big deal. But make no mistake, you're sliding down into a pool of decay. But once you understand what's happening inside your brain when you drink to relieve stress, it's much easier to resolve the cognitive dissonance around drinking and kids. Once you do that, you'll be able to push off and fly away from the temptation. So let's look at the internal evidence first. Are you okay with how much you're drinking as a parent? I know I wasn't. I justified it. I made jokes about it, like the memes we see on social media. But deep down, I knew it wasn't right. I can remember thinking, how would we drive the kids to the hospital if we had to? We're both drunk. And I've heard countless stories of people who grew up with parents who drank. They were all so embarrassed by their loved one's behavior that they swore they would never be like that. Yet they come to me truly not knowing how they've ended up becoming their parents. They're repeating the exact same behavior they witnessed as kids, and they feel powerless to stop it. The statistics on alcohol and child abuse are tragic, but maybe you're not that bad. Maybe you only have a drink or two every now and then when the kids are particularly challenging. Children are incredibly perceptive. When you say, "Hang on, honey, I'll play with you as soon as I get a beer," they pick up on the subtle message that a drink is more important than they are. What words are you using with your kids, and what messages are you sending to them? I can remember my own son telling me he didn't like it when my lips turned purple. That was a sign to him that I was changing into someone he didn't like, someone who was only half there. Children report that when their parents are drinking, it's like they really aren't present. They're distracted and only paying half attention. We tell our kids that this is mommy juice and to do as we say, not as we do. But it's human nature to want what we can't have. So by withholding this magical liquid from our kids, they're actually being trained to want it more. Studies show that children who grow up seeing their parents drunk are 3 times more likely to have problems with alcohol and drugs. They have more eating disorders, and they're 4 times more likely to suffer from depression. Some parents offer sips of alcohol to their kids to prevent this forbidden allure of something being just for grown-ups. But research is showing that these same kids are actually more likely to drink as adults. We're subconsciously conditioning our own children to believe that they cannot handle life without alcohol. And is that true? Is that what you want for them? How will our children believe us when we tell them about the dangers of drinking if we're drinking ourselves? When they're eventually told that it's addictive and that it can rob you of your memories and your health, they're going to start worrying about us. Or they won't believe the facts because mom and dad wouldn't drink if it was really that dangerous. I remember learning about how cigarettes cause cancer and being terrified for my friends' parents and other people I cared about who smoked. Each of these ACT technique chapters are trying to undo some subconscious belief you adopted growing up. Are you unknowingly setting your own kids up to have the same misguided beliefs about alcohol? Okay, so let's talk about the external evidence and what's actually happening in your body. When I first started drinking, it was a fun social experience. But over time, it turned into something I felt I desperately needed, especially after my second son was born. It was a very stressful time in my life when I was traveling for work every other week internationally. I felt guilty because I wasn't home. And when I was home, my husband worked long into the night after the kids were in bed. Wine was more than just a fun way to relax. It became my friend and my ally. It wasn't something I just wanted. It was something I thought I needed. And here's the thing. It wasn't my fault. And if you're in the same boat, it's not your fault either. Your body is actually trying to help you survive. Dr. Kevin McCauley has spent his career studying the brain science behind addiction, and he talks about something called the hedonic system. This is the part of our brain that pursues pleasure as a means of survival. Remember, your brain is always seeking survival above everything else. And interestingly, intense stress can be seen by your brain as a serious threat. Here's how it works. Your hedonic system runs off a baseline reading. In times of severe stress, that baseline goes up, and things that used to be pleasurable, like taking a walk or reading a book, don't cut it anymore, and you need something more to lower your stress levels. And that means you're more likely to reach for alcohol or another addictive substance to relieve stress. By drinking to relieve stress from parenting or anything else, you've literally rewired your brain to believe that's the only way you can survive it. And this is how we get stuck in the pitcher plant. And people will just say, just stop drinking for heaven's sakes, you're about to lose your kids. But at this point, it's not that simple. Your evolutionary mind now overrides your common sense. And since survival trumps all, and your brain equates alcohol with survival, you literally cannot resist when it gets to this point. Your brain starts to tell you that you actually need to drink alcohol to survive. Yet we know that throughout history and in all parts of the world, people handle parenting just fine without alcohol. So we're not born with this need to drink to handle stress. We're conditioned over time to believe it. And all the jokes and the social media memes we read and share are sending this message loud and clear. Our own parents might have perpetuated the message. We're telling ourselves we can't handle it. We're not resilient enough. We're weak. And when we do that, we're giving our power over to alcohol. But before you come down on yourself like I know I did, please remember that we are all just doing the best we can and making the best decisions we know how to make with the tools and information we currently have. Until you listen to this chapter, maybe the only information you had was a funny joke you heard or your own experience that dealing with your kids is easier when you drink. But now you have new tools. You know the truth. You've been fed false information. You've been tricked into thinking that alcohol makes life simpler when in fact it's the opposite. You now have new information. You understand what's happening with your hedonic system. You're aware of what your drinking is doing to your kids. And you're making a great new choice. As you take this 30-day break from alcohol, you have the opportunity to become more mindful and decide whether you want to go in a different direction. So now you can do the best you can with this new information. Turnaround. The opposite of I need a drink to handle my kids, or I'm a better parent when I drink, is I don't need a drink to handle my kids, or I'm a worse parent when I drink. Come up with as many ways as you can that the opposite is as true or truer in your life than the original belief. Day 15. Social life and dating. Queen Latifah said, "Be bold, be brave enough to be your true self." Social skills. Look, social skills are exactly that. Skills. You need to learn and practice them to get good at them. So many of us start drinking at a young age, and we never develop the skills to feel confident talking in social settings with new people or going on a date without alcohol. We don't crack bad jokes and learn how to recover. We don't get shut down and move on. We don't experience heartbreak without the numbing effects of a drink to make us feel better. It takes practice. If we were all perfect at everything from the moment we were born, what would even be the point? Life is all about experimentation and growth. And the good news is that it's never too late to learn how to interact socially with confidence, even if you'd prefer to be home alone with a book. But don't put pressure on yourself. Don't expect that you'll find your soulmate right out of the gate. Give yourself the gift of making mistakes without judgment. It's okay to dance crazy and be expressive while you're sober. People like it. They admire it, and they wish they could do it. And the best part is you'll remember it later. If it was a good experience, you'll cherish the memory. And if it was a bad experience, you can learn from it and grow your social skill set. Small talk can be stressful, and no matter how extroverted you are, walking into a room full of strangers is often nerve-wracking. It's a common human experience and very natural to feel uncomfortable meeting and socializing with new people. It's actually believed that this mechanism of initial discomfort around strangers helped protect us when we lived in a more tribal society. It ensured we were cautious as we got to know others and would not say or do anything that would lead to discord among tribes. Alcohol seems to provide the perfect solution, but with all sorts of icky consequences. So instead of alcohol, here's an easy way to engage people in conversation without feeling awkward. Ask questions. Seriously. The question mark is the introvert's best friend. Get the other person talking and you won't have to do all the work. How was their day? What did they do for lunch? What job would they have if they didn't have to make money? What hobbies do they enjoy? Where did they grow up? How many siblings do they have? Where did their grandparents grow up? It goes on and on. You could spend an entire evening without having to talk about yourself at all. And of course, whoever you're talking to is probably going to ask you questions too. But it's so much more comfortable to answer a direct question than it is to come up with awkward small talk. And the truth is that being genuinely curious about others is both fun and rewarding. Dating without drinking. If you're single, you might be thinking that there's no way you'll be able to meet people or go out on dates during this experiment. Maybe you rely on alcohol to make you funnier or feel more attractive. Maybe drinking is the only way you have enough courage to go out and talk to strangers in social situations. Or maybe you feel like no one could even be attracted to you without the wit and charm you think comes from a bottle. So maybe during this experiment, you practice caring for yourself a bit more. Look in the mirror. What qualities do you like the most? Do you have a killer set of biceps? Are your ankles shapely? Do you have an amazing smile that can light up a room? Focus on what you love about yourself, and others will be drawn to you. Again, we think loving ourselves means thinking our bodies are sexy or thinking we're smart enough or good enough, etc., when really we should be learning to love ourselves as we love our children. Because we exist. Love your body because it keeps you alive. Take care of it because it takes care of you. Treat it tenderly because you care for it like you would a child. Again, you don't love your kids because they're attractive enough. You love them because they're your kids. And we didn't create ourselves, so again, what right do we have to treat ourselves badly? Make your own dating rules. Next, let's examine this assumption. Drinking is the only way I have enough courage to go out and talk to strangers. Okay, the first thing to know about yourself is whether you're an introvert or an extrovert. Some people just aren't wired to hit the party circuit and hook up with people they don't know. Yet our culture idolizes the extroverts, the people who crave social interaction. But a full 50% of people are actually introverts. They would much prefer to interact with one or two friends in a low-key setting. And if that's you, great. Don't force yourself to be something you're not. I'm not suggesting you can't ever meet new people or go out on first dates. I'm saying that you can do it in a way that feels more comfortable and true to you. If you've had to have alcohol to meet people, maybe you just need a different approach. Instead of going to big boozy parties with loud music, try taking up a hobby and joining a club full of people interested in the same things. Maybe you join a rock climbing gym or a country club where you can sign up to meet people on the golf course. Who made the rule that a first date is always meeting for a drink? You can make up your own rules. A date could be taking a class together or volunteering together or having coffee on a Sunday morning. Be unconventional. It's cool. Alcohol and attraction. I feel more attractive once I'm buzzed. I can let loose and stop focusing on my flaws. Guess what? Even though you might feel more attractive, the opposite is happening. It's easy to believe alcohol is helping because your inhibitions are lowered, and other drunk people around you have dulled their senses with alcohol too. But if 100 people are drinking heavily, 80 of them wish they could enjoy themselves with less booze. This might surprise you, but when people are looking for a partner, they actually find minimal alcohol consumption much more attractive. Even when I was drinking, I tended to respect non-drinkers, and I felt that they would make better partners and parents. And I secretly thought it was so badass when someone said, "I don't drink." A pretty girl or a hot guy who has self-confidence without drinking, super attractive. Today, I want you to think about an alternative way to meet new people, one that's comfortable and easy. Or if you're already in a committed relationship, think about how you can take your partner out on a date where alcohol doesn't enter into the equation. Could you go on a midday bike ride and picnic? Could you find a lake and go swimming at midnight? Get yourself outside the usual dinner, drinks, and a movie date mode, and you'll surprise yourself. If you're in different surroundings, engaging in different activities, there's a chance you won't even think about adding alcohol to the mix. And any time you catch yourself feeling awkward, ask a question. That's sure to take the pressure off and get the conversation flowing again. Day 15, journal questions. Remember, all the wisdom you seek is actually inside you. The most important words in this experiment are the ones you tell yourself. So take some time and answer these questions in a separate journal. That's the most effective. Or maybe even make a voice memo to yourself. Or simply speak the words out loud for only you to hear. 1. Meeting new people. Are you afraid to meet new people or socialize without a drink? Why? What do you think will happen? Be specific and detail your fears. 2. Exploring your fears. Now, how does what you've written make you feel? Don't judge if your feelings are right or wrong. Just notice how they all make you feel. 3. Is it true? Look at all your thoughts and fears again and ask yourself, are they true? Can you be absolutely 100% certain that they are true? 4. Are you willing to find out? What are you willing to experiment with and be curious about in order to discover the truth? Are you willing to go on a date sober or to a sales conference or to a happy hour? Whatever you decide, go into the experience with 100% curiosity and zero expectations. Now journal about your experience. Day 15 reflections from alcoholexperiment.com. Joy says, day 15 and going strong. I've been lucky so far in that I've not been in a social situation where I have to make small talk with strangers. That will change soon, and it will be very interesting to see how I respond, because in the past, I've always used alcohol to feel comfortable. Russell says, Day 15 alcohol-free. Feeling good, and I'm finally sleeping through the night now. I no longer have physical cravings for alcohol, but sometimes still have what I call routine cravings, which is when I perform a task that I used to associate with alcohol, such as watching TV or movies or just relaxing on the patio in the evenings. During these moments, it just feels like something is missing. But I'm not missing alcohol at all or its negative effects, and look forward to creating a new routine for myself alcohol-free. Alexa says, I can recall wanting to get my drink on before meeting a new person so that talkative, personable me could feel comfortable and come out and play. Sober me, overthinking me, quiet me, didn't seem like someone a new person would like. Drinking did feel like a way to get out of my head and be able to talk and to meet and drop all the judgmental stuff that goes on in my head when I'm sober. What happened though, and I can see now, is that there was a loss of connection to the other person. The connection I felt was more illusion than reality. I was so concerned with being personable, I forgot to be real. Drinking allowed me to chat up my first husband at a bar. If I was sober, I would have never even wanted to get to know him. He would have bored me to tears. I divorced him after 5 years. But can I really say that not marrying him would have made my life better? After all, we have a great daughter, and I learned about myself. Maybe I can say this. Had I not been drinking, not chatting up a boy I would have never otherwise chatted up or even been attracted to, I may have saved myself years of grief. I can now appreciate raw, uncomfortable, sober, weird-feeling moments that have not been smoothed over by the easy-breezy flow of alcohol. Is the awkward moment something to embrace instead of fear? Yes, I think it is. Day 16. The power of belief. Tony Robbins said, beliefs have the power to create and the power to destroy. Human beings have the awesome ability to take any experience of their lives and create a meaning that disempowers them or one that can literally save their lives. You've heard this before and you'll hear it again. Your mind is incredibly powerful. It can be a staunch ally or your worst enemy, depending on how you use it. The good news is that once you learn how the mind works, you can take control and use its power to change anything in your life. If you believe that you're going to be miserable without a drink in your hand at a social occasion, sporting event, concert, or even home alone, you will be miserable. If you believe you're going to be lonely, you will be. If you believe you're going to be bored, you will be. And if you believe that this moment is miserable, it will be. I'm not asking you to counter these beliefs. Simply thinking, I believe I'll be happy without alcohol, isn't enough. That's using willpower, and we all know that willpower doesn't last in the long term. Worse, your brain knows that you're lying to it. You have to actually believe what you're telling yourself. So how do you make that happen? Can you actually install new beliefs like you're installing software on a computer? Absolutely. When you start to question your beliefs, you create space in your mind for new beliefs to be installed. Conditioning. Let's talk about conditioning for a moment. Neuropsychologists agree that we spend our lifetimes being conditioned. We're teaching our brains what to expect in any circumstance. Whether what we expect actually happens doesn't matter because we will manufacture circumstances that deliver exactly what we expect. And this phenomenon has been studied over and over again. As we've just learned, if you expect to be miserable, you will be. If you expect that going alcohol-free for 30 days won't be a big deal, it won't be. The ACT technique is designed to help decondition you, to change your beliefs and what you expect. Once you shake the foundations of those conditioned beliefs, you can start to move forward without being hindered by unhelpful or unhealthy beliefs. A major fear for people before they start the alcohol experiment is that they won't be able to do it. They don't believe it will be possible to stop drinking, even for a short time, because of whatever their circumstance is. They don't believe it will be possible to be alcohol-free and happy at the same time, or alcohol-free and relaxed at the same time. And that's a completely understandable fear, but it's based on a false belief. Once you start to see other people being successful, you start to believe that you can be successful too. This is what's so great about the alcohol experiment community. You get to see other people who are alcohol-free and happy. They're making it, and you can too. Confirmation bias. So you know you're being conditioned to believe certain things and expect certain things in life. But you also help cement those beliefs into your mind with something called confirmation bias. Have you ever tried to look something up online and stopped looking once you found an article or a website that confirmed what you thought? Take dietary fat, for instance. There are plenty of studies and articles and forums out there that claim fat is bad for you, but there are just as many that claim the exact opposite. So which do you believe? You believe what you've been conditioned to believe, unless you're consciously trying to change that conditioning. Confirmation bias doesn't only happen when we're surfing the net or browsing social media. When drinking becomes uncomfortable for us, we develop cognitive dissonance. The mind is uncomfortable because we're wrestling with two conflicting ideas. Alcohol relaxes us versus alcohol is making us miserable. That dissonance is incredibly painful, so the brain looks for ways to ease the pain. How? By looking for confirmation one way or the other. Maybe we share social media posts about the benefits of red wine. That confirms wine is good for us, and so the dissonance is eased. Maybe we put funny plaques on the wall like, "Gone drinking, will return when I can't remember why I started." What that does is it makes us feel better because it's funny, but subconsciously, it also makes us feel weak because it's confirming our belief that we need alcohol to simply deal with our lives. Recently, I've noticed more and more slogans that are supposed to be funny, but really aren't. "I'm not addicted to wine, we're just in a very committed relationship." And, "A day without wine is like, just kidding, I have no idea." These plaques are for sale for women to put up in their kitchens. But the truth is that they're just justifying an addiction. We're using confirmation bias to justify heavier and heavier amounts of drinking. Visualization. Now you know the ways you reinforce your beliefs. What are some of the ways you can go about breaking and reconstructing them? One of my favorite ways is to use visualization. I know that might sound a little bit woo-woo, but stick with me here. Numerous studies show that the mind can't tell the difference between a real memory and a powerfully visualized memory. One strong visualization is to try to picture yourself going out and having a great time without alcohol. When I first gave up drinking, before I would go out, I would visualize the entire evening. I'd imagine myself going out for the evening with some friends. I would imagine the restaurant we were going to. I'd imagine ordering a big steak dinner, and instead of the usual bottle of wine, visualize ordering a tonic and lime. And then I'd visualize myself laughing and laughing and laughing and having a great time. And it worked. The brain can't tell the difference because when we have colorful, vivid, convincing pictures, it essentially tries to make those pictures a reality. So those visualizations are actually affecting your future reality. How cool is that? One mistake people make is to think about and visualize what we don't want to happen. But the mind doesn't necessarily understand the word "don't." You get whatever you think about, which in this case is the opposite of what you do want. So if you imagine, "I just don't want to be sitting there being miserable," but you're thinking of yourself sitting there being miserable, that's what your brain works from. It tries to make that scenario a reality. But if you think of yourself going out and having a great time, then your brain tries to make that scenario a reality. And just saying it out loud doesn't work. You have to visualize all the nuances, the entire scene, and be as specific as you possibly can when you visualize. Mentally rehearse what you're wearing, what you're thinking, what you're saying. Take the time to sit for 5 or 6 minutes, set a timer, close your eyes, and go through the visualization. Don't worry and think, what if this doesn't work? Try it and then be as specific as possible. And if you want to boost the effects even further, add emotions to your visualization. How will you feel going out to dinner and ordering an iced tea? I'm going to feel amazing. I'm going to feel so in control of myself and so proud that I'm having so much fun without alcohol. Then try to feel the feelings in the moment while you're visualizing. Get that excited feeling in your chest, anticipation. Feel the tingling in your hands. Put that big smile on your face. The more emotions you visualize, the more powerful your visualizations will be. Today, think of the next stressful thing you're going to go through when you might have been tempted to give in and have a drink. Maybe it's going out with your friends. Maybe it's just surviving another stressful day at work. Then go through the visualization exercise and visualize the experience exactly how you want it to go. Make some notes about it in your journal, and then after the event, come down and write down exactly what happened. Did you get what you expected? Did your visualization come true? Day 16, journal questions. Remember, all the wisdom you seek is actually inside you. The most important words in this experiment are the ones you tell yourself. So take some time and answer these questions in a separate journal. That's the most effective. Or maybe even make a voice memo to yourself. Or simply speak the words out loud for only you to hear. 1. Visualization. Think of the next time you might be tempted to drink. Think of it in detail and then spend some time writing down your vision of the experience exactly as you want it to go. 2. Reflection. Return to your journal after the event or situation that you previously visualized and write down exactly what happened. Was it what you expected? Did your visualization come true? Day 16 Reflections from AlcoholExperiment.com. Cammie says, "Wow, I'm so stoked. This is the longest I've been alcohol-free in probably a year and a half. I'm thrilled to have broken the cycle and to be creating new healthy habits and altering my neural pathways. My husband discreetly had a few drinks last night. I could smell it on him. He was respectful and not obvious or drunk. But the best thing is, I didn't desire to join him. I didn't even ask or bring it up. I'm too content with the changes I've made for myself and the future to fall back into the bottle." Regina says, "Day 16 and I'm so proud of myself. I feel alive and present in this wonderful life. Keep going. It gets better." Bailey says, "I used visualization and made it through my first event alcohol-free. Turning down wine and beer was easier than I thought. At the same time, I do struggle thinking about how I'll get through this summer. I waffle between thinking my problem is not all that bad, and yet I've tried to stop drinking 4 times in the past 5 years. It may not be that bad, but I'm uncomfortable with it, and I want more out of life. I know that overall, it's not going to enhance my health in the long run. I definitely have my good days and bad days. Only about 16 days alcohol-free now. But I would really love for this to be my last attempt. I cannot wait until being alcohol-free is automatic and as easy as being a non-smoker. I keep reminding myself that I kick the cigarettes. Here's to the day when to drink, not drink isn't even an issue, because I just don't care that I don't drink." Act 8. Alcohol is my friend. Awareness. Alcohol helps when I'm feeling lonely. Many people feel like they're less lonely when they drink. It's like even if their friends don't understand them, Uncle Jack or Jack Daniel's whiskey or old granddad bourbon whiskey totally gets them. Alcohol seems to keep the loneliness away. I know this was true for me. Clarity. You probably do feel less alone when you drink, and at some point, you might have had a bad day, and decided to try drinking alone. There's no one watching you when you drink by yourself, so you can drink a lot quickly. You don't have a social situation to slow you down, so your blood alcohol content rises fast, and you feel that quick hit of happiness right away. And it feels euphoric for that first 30 minutes or so. And naturally, when you've experienced this firsthand, the belief that alcohol fights off loneliness settles into your subconscious and makes itself at home. And when you drink to overcome pain, the alcohol actually has a more pronounced effect because it's a numbing agent than when we drink for pleasure. So what is actually going on? That first feeling of euphoria takes away any discomfort you were feeling earlier, the very discomfort that made you decide to have a drink in the first place. And you probably feel pretty good being alone, maybe for the first time in a long time. For most people, being alone isn't fun. It's awkward and uncomfortable. But when you add alcohol, suddenly it seems great. So of course you feel like booze is the thing that's fighting off the loneliness. But it's nothing more than a chemical concoction. Yet, you can even start to develop a friend-like relationship with it. It's not that alcohol is actually your friend, it's that you feel the pain of loneliness less when you're drinking. Let me ask you some questions, though. Since you started drinking alone, has your life become more or less solitary? In my experience, I looked forward to drinking, and when I was drinking alone, I could pretty much do whatever I wanted. One woman told me she knew something needed to change when she started looking forward to her evening glass of wine even more than her kids coming home from school. Has your life become more social or less social since you started drinking alone? It's normal for people to start avoiding social situations, even ones where they used to drink with their friends, because they figure out they can drink as much as they want at home with no one judging them. And they don't even have to deal with people. Bonus. So soon, you might be finding reasons to excuse yourself from any social situation just so you can drink alone. Are you closer to or further away from the people you love? From your children? Your partner? I thought my drinking brought me closer to my partner because I could unwind around him. But over the years, as I increased my drinking, I often found myself in bed with a glass of wine while he was downstairs watching TV. The alcohol actually drove us apart. Is drinking the only social activity your friends seem to do these days? You might be feeling lonely because alcohol is the only shared experience you have anymore. I remember when I stopped drinking, a dear lifelong friend I'd known since kindergarten stopped coming over to hang out. And it was a long time before I finally found out that she didn't think we'd have anything to talk about or do if we weren't drinking margaritas together. This took me totally by surprise. I had no idea she felt like that. I'd known her for over 30 years, and we'd only been drinking together for the past 10. Even though we'd shared a huge history, she had this overwhelming fear because recently we only had alcohol in common. She was worried that it would be awkward. I told her that every new experience without alcohol takes a little while to get used to, and I asked her to come over. If it was awkward or uncomfortable, well, at least we'd get a good laugh out of it. So she came over for the first time in 2 years, and we had the best time together. We talked about our families and politics and religion. We laughed till our stomachs hurt. We had so much fun connecting with each other that we completely forgot about the movie and bike ride we'd planned. And now we're closer than we've ever been, all because we showed up and connected with each other. That was something that alcohol had been stealing from us all along, and we didn't even know it. Now let's look at the external evidence for a minute. There are actual physiological reasons that alcohol robs us of our ability to connect with other people. Alcohol slows down the speed of your neurons firing in your brain. This means you think more slowly. You take longer to respond. And the longer alcohol is in your system, the harder you have to concentrate just to speak at all. You don't retain much of what's happening around you, so you retreat further and further into yourself. Alcohol blurs the edges around what's actually going on, so you also become emotionally withdrawn. Here's something to try during this experiment. Go out with a bunch of your friends while they're drinking and you're not, and then try to have a real heart-to-heart conversation with them. You'll find it's nearly impossible to get them to take you seriously. And you can see it in their eyes that they're not entirely present. They're distracted. Maybe they're too quick to laugh or respond like they're trying too hard. And if this behavior surprises you, realize that you never noticed it before because you were drinking too. You were also withdrawn into your own little world. I didn't notice any of this until I stopped drinking. How can two people form a true and lasting connection when they're both worried about falling off their chairs? You have to have other times when you're not drinking with your friends if you want to experience a true connection and dispel any feelings of loneliness. And real human connection comes from being vulnerable. Researcher Brené Brown has centered her life's work on this idea. Think about it. When people seem completely put off and perfect, do you want to connect with them? Probably not. You might want to be like them, but you don't want to reach out and talk to them. That comes only from when a person is vulnerable and shows their flaws as well as their strengths. Yet we try to pretend we're perfect all the time. We think if we pretend we're great, then people will want to be friends with us. But it's only when we admit we're hurt or disappointed when we're not perfect that people connect and our loneliness subsides. Even if you and your best friend experience a drunken moment of weeping and a confessional, "I love you, man," chances are pretty good that neither of you will remember it in the morning. Alcohol makes you think you're connecting when you're really withdrawn. If we truly want to combat loneliness, we need to be courageous enough to be raw and real. We need to talk about our struggles. The more I show up with my real stories, the more people come back to me with their own real stories. We're all struggling together. And the more we pretend that we have it all together, the more we actually push other people away. Drinking Annie was pretty good at small talks and making jokes, but she wasn't great at making lasting connections. In fact, despite all the perceived closeness and the fact we poured out all our drunken secrets to one another, the people I drank with most were not people I felt I could call on if I was really having a hard time. As alcohol steals our ability to connect, the more alone we become. It masquerades as our best friend, and all our relationships become superficial. No one is truly themselves, even after a few drinks, and we lose the ability to be truly vulnerable. We lose our chance for real, true relationships. As my drinking progressed, I found that it isolated me more and more. The more embarrassed I became about my struggle, the more worried I was about people judging me, and the more I wanted to be alone with the bottle. Drinking often starts out as a social activity, but then it becomes something that we do alone and sometimes even in secret, driving us further and further away from true human connection. Turnaround. The opposite of alcohol is my friend is alcohol is not my friend, or alcohol is my enemy. Come up with as many ways as you can that the opposite is as true or truer in your life than the original belief. Day 17. Relieving boredom without drinking. Albert Einstein said, "Boredom leads to creativity. Imagination is more important than knowledge." If drinking used to be a major activity for you, this experiment might leave you with more time on your hands than you thought it would. And that is actually a great thing. Yet you might feel a bit bored. So let's explore that emotion today. Interestingly, boredom is one of the top reasons people go back to drinking. So it's important to get a handle on this uncomfortable emotion so it can't undermine your experiment. Boredom can be a loaded topic, especially when it involves other people. There's a lot of implied guilt and blame involved, as you'll soon discover. The common belief among regular drinkers is that alcohol relieves their boredom and makes boring people easier to tolerate. But when you get right down to it, what is boredom? We might define it as a disinterest in the world around us or even in our own thoughts. It's like saying that our lives are not enough for us. That being alive is just not enough, that we need something else. The concept of boredom is nothing new. References to it appeared in ancient Pompeii as early as the 1st century AD. And I imagine it's probably been around since human beings first existed. Boredom is an incredibly uncomfortable state for many people. Scientists studied this by putting people in a room for 15 minutes to be alone with their thoughts. The only other item in the room was a device they could push to give themselves an electric shock. And 80% of the people decided to shock themselves and cause themselves pain rather than sit and be bored. One person actually shocked himself 180 times. We brush off boredom as this trivial thing that we should be able to simply snap out of, but researchers are finding that it's not trivial at all, and there are some fascinating connections between boredom and addiction to substances like alcohol. When we were young, we were taught to feel guilty about being bored. I remember my dad telling me that boredom doesn't exist, and it was all in my head. And in school, children are often told to stop complaining or that they're weak-willed and unimaginative if they're bored. Some parents will say, only boring people get bored. Or, if you're bored, I'll give you something to do. And of course, that thing is always unpleasant, like cleaning your room or taking out the trash. And over time, we learn to be ashamed of this state of boredom. So we have this feeling that we don't know what to do about. And our parents and our teachers and other authority figures tell us we shouldn't be feeling it. And that sets us up for classic cognitive dissonance. We feel bad or embarrassed that we're bored, so we seek out ways to change our state of mind. Some people eat, some people mindlessly scan social media, and many of us reach for a drink. And for a short time, alcohol numbs the boredom and the guilt we feel about being bored in the first place. Back in 1986, psychologists at the University of Oregon developed a test to study boredom. It's called the Boredom Proneness Scale, and you can actually take it online. It's not surprising that people who are easily bored are more prone to addiction. Teenagers who report being easily bored are 50% more likely to try drinking, illegal drugs, or smoking. Think back for a moment. Have you always been prone to boredom? Or did you have creative activities to engage in? What were they? And how did you handle boredom before you started drinking? But it's really important to understand that boredom isn't necessarily a bad thing. I read a study where doctors put participants inside an MRI machine. When they reported feeling bored, there was a 5% drop in their overall brain activity. But there were huge increases in activity in certain areas, specifically parts of the brain that recall autobiographical facts, the parts that seek self-knowledge, and the creative center, where the hypothetical situations are invented. All those creative parts of the brain were much more active, even though overall brain activity was lower. Interesting, isn't it? Boredom may well be responsible for all of the great works of art and literature, your favorite movies, and technological innovations. Albert Einstein was a notoriously bored person. Legend had it that his famous theory of relativity came about when he was particularly bored in an algebra class and was imagining that he could escape by being faster than a beam of light. What amazing things do you have inside you that are just waiting to be shared with the world? And some people believe that true bliss and contentment actually happen on the other side of boredom. They believe that boredom is a sublime emotion, something to be savored and appreciated. In fact, researchers are urging parents not to fill their kids' summer schedules with tons of activity. They suggest setting kids up in situations where they will be bored in order to foster their ability to be still in their emotions. Children need to develop the ability to pay attention to the little things that actually bring lasting joy. It's a skill we're robbing our children of by providing constant on-demand entertainment. Of course, beyond a certain point, boredom does become unhealthy. Studies show that when people and animals are bored too long, they can actually go insane. Now, when you're drunk, you aren't capable of feeling boredom because you've numbed your senses and emotions. Boredom is your brain telling you that it needs to be stimulated. So think of some ways to do that. My favorite ways to relieve boredom involve activities where I'm striving to reach a goal. Since my husband and I started Taekwondo, we're always working to improve our skills and move from white belt through the colored belts, and eventually we hope to earn our black belts. Sustained growth and achievement is built right in, and happiness is often found in areas of growth. Maybe you want to write a novel, and you can check off the chapters as they're completed. Even try something as simple as walking, and that can give you a sense of achievement. Try a GPS app to track your daily miles as you walk the distance it would take you to make it to Rome. And then celebrate with a big Italian dinner party when you reach your virtual Rome. The truth is that when you're drunk, everything feels the same. Whether you're eating a nice dinner, you're at a concert, or you're home watching Netflix, it's all the same numb, fuzzy feeling. Every experience you have feels exactly the same. After I gave up drinking, I saw that life has so much variety to offer, and we need all our senses intact in order to experience it. When we take the time to appreciate it, life without alcohol is the opposite of boring. And what about the belief that drinking makes other people more interesting? My answer to that is to ask why you're with those people in the first place. I certainly understand needing to be at a business or networking function where you don't want to be, and I did my fair share of drinking to deal with people I had no interest in. But when I did that, I robbed myself of the ability to form true connections with people who might actually be worth getting to know if I gave them a chance. When you drink to make someone else more interesting, you're the one who gets cheated. You're poisoning yourself just so you can be around someone you don't want to be around in the first place. I found that if I pay attention, I can usually find something worth knowing about everyone. And if I really can't stand someone, I can politely excuse myself and go find someone else to talk to. I don't need a drink to do that. So what do you think? While it's true that alcohol does temporarily relieve boredom by slowing down your brain, it also numbs your ability to experience and appreciate the things that bring you joy. Given what you know now about the creative centers of your brain lighting up during periods of boredom, are you more likely to put up with those uncomfortable emotions to see what's on the other side? Just imagine what might emerge. Today, remember that boredom has a purpose. Turning it off robs you and the world of something beautiful and important that only you can offer. Try just for now to sit with your boredom. Let it wash over you. Allow the discomfort and see what happens. And then make a list of all the activities you'd like to try someday. Don't hold yourself back or put anything off limits. If you want to go skydiving or drive race cars, add them to the list. You want to quit your job and start your own business? Great. How about taking up ballroom dancing or shipwreck diving? Perfect. Spend some creative energy making a long, wild list. Then start thinking about which activity you want to do first and go for it. Even if all you do is a little research on the internet, that's a great start. You have something amazing inside of you that's just waiting to be created. And boredom is your brain crying out for stimulation. You simply just need a healthy kind of stimulation. Day 17, journal questions. Remember, all the wisdom you seek is actually inside you. The most important words in this experiment are the ones you tell yourself. So take some time and answer these questions in a separate journal. That's the most effective. Or maybe even make a voice memo to yourself. Or simply speak the words out loud for only you to hear. 1. Reflection. Reflect on today's lesson and in your own words, talk about the benefits of boredom. 2. Your anti-boredom list. Spend a few minutes making a list of all the activities you'd like to try someday. Don't hold yourself back or put anything off limits. Spend some creative energy writing a list that truly excites you. Day 17 Reflections from AlcoholExperiment.com. Tim says, I can relate to the boredom. Boredom has always been with me, and I always answered with, hey, a beer sounds good, or let's get a little wine, or how about a cocktail? I felt a lot of tension last night, I think due to my unanswered boredom. My wife was having her wine, and I was drinking water, which was not a problem, but the tension was coming from boredom. I didn't know it at the time, but it makes perfect sense now. This is an excellent learning adventure. There is some discomfort, there is some pain, but seeing my old lifelong friend, Al Cajal, being exposed for the backstabbing, toxic, miserable substance that he really is, that is refreshing, exciting, hopeful, and motivating. I can't wait to keep living this life. Bryce says, I found that alcohol was keeping me unfocused and scattered and afraid to tackle all the things I want to do. I'm coming out of that fog. All I want now is to push myself in ways that I never have before. Alcohol for me was a lot about fear and lack of confidence. And this is starting to change. I feel great today. And Julian says, I woke up this morning feeling euphoric. I couldn't wait to start the day. I can't remember the last time I felt this good for more than one day at a time. There have been so many years of wine-filled evenings, leaving me exhausted and disappointed. I used to be a morning person, optimistic and energetic, but in the last few years, I've become down and blue and lethargic, struggling to get through the day until 7 p.m. when I can have that first glass. I really think I lost myself in the blur. The last 17 days have been a revelation. I think the old me is on his way back. Day 18. Why tolerance is literally a buzzkill. Thomas Merton said, happiness is not a matter of intensity, but of balance and order and rhythm and harmony. The science behind tolerance. Do you believe that a high alcohol tolerance is a good thing? I used to. People would make fun of me and say I was a cheap date because I got drunk so quickly. I didn't like that, so I consciously tried to increase my tolerance so that I could keep up with my coworkers. Other people consider high tolerance a bad thing and consciously try to decrease their tolerance so that they can get drunk faster and not have to spend so much money for the same buzz. But alcohol tolerance is your body's way of trying to regulate itself in the midst of confusing signals and chaos. Let's look at the brain science so you can see what's actually going on when you consume alcohol. Your brain has what's called a pleasure circuit, and it's made up of the prefrontal cortex, the nucleus accumbens, and the ventral tegmental area, or the VTA. Alcohol affects your prefrontal cortex and makes you feel less inhibited. It gives you a temporary feeling of pleasure. Unfortunately, the more impaired your prefrontal cortex becomes, the less you're able to say no to that next drink. You're also less able to resist the dumb things you think about doing or saying. An impaired prefrontal cortex is why people drive when they shouldn't. You've damaged the part of your brain responsible for good judgment. After all, that's what your inhibitions are. As the alcohol hits your system, the VTA stimulates dopamine release. Dopamine helps you feel pleasure. One of the main areas of your brain that actually registers enjoyment is the nucleus accumbens. And it's not surprising that addictive substances stimulate these areas of the brain more effectively than everyday pleasures, such as taking a walk with your dog, or watching a movie, or enjoying a good meal. In fact, addictive substances stimulate pleasure chemicals far beyond normal levels. And that might sound great at first, but remember that your body is always trying to protect you by maintaining homeostasis. It wants to keep you in balance. So after drinking, your inhibitions are low and your pleasure chemicals are unnaturally high. And part of your brain realizes that no good can come from that if left unchecked. So as I explained earlier, it releases a counter chemical called